Kelly Effect.
I'm a big fan of the show.
Chuck O'Shelly, and he's been known for many years as a blind JFK researcher specializing in intelligence agency involvement in multiple assassinations, propaganda, and other global criminal operations in the 20th and 21st centuries.
Your listeners are extremely fortunate to have you.
And now the most underrated voice in all media.
Chuck O'Shelly!
This indeed is the O'Shelly Effect broadcast live, and it is December 5th, 2018, allegedly, according to that thing we call a calendar. Guess what? A lot of people would be celebrating a lot of interesting anniversaries on this particular day, and there's a great deal of historiography to be studied. However, it seems to me as though my friends in the allegedly alternative media did not take as much notice as they normally would to an interesting 40th anniversary, which did just occur in November. Now, you guys are very familiar with me talking about the JFK assassination. I certainly covered it a lot and will continue to do so. But there was something that happened in the course of my lifetime. Now, I grant you I was only 6 years old in 1978, but if my memory does serve me correctly, on November 18th, this is when the greatest mass murder, and I do mean to say mass murder of Americans, to my knowledge, previous to 9/11, occurred without a war. And that happened in a place called Guyana. Now, it is often referenced. It is often discussed. People immediately, when they start to talk about religious cults, when they start to talk about various issues, maniacal leaders, religious extremism, and the dangers of it, they talk about Jim Jones. Well, tonight I don't want to talk about Jim Jones too much. I want to talk about exactly what happened, though, in Jonestown. I want to talk about what happened in Georgetown. I want to talk with one of the most interesting authors I have ever spoken to, who is telling a personal story. And apparently a lot of new listeners were totally unaware that this is in my archives. So I'm going to revisit this story tonight, after the 40th anniversary already occurred, with Laura Johnston Cole. Now, Laura is a remarkably interesting individual and was intricately involved in the events that occurred. Now, was she present at the murder? And yes, I did say murder. I didn't say suicide, although there may have been elements of that involved there, and who knows? But quite honestly, to my knowledge, there's still 200 bodies which ended up not being claimed. Those ended up in a mass grave, and a satisfactory explanation of exactly how over 900 people died has never fully been offered regarding this event. I don't want to necessarily focus on just that event. I want to take a look behind what was going on. And, of course, the author that I am talking to is with me, and she wrote a story called Survivor. Actually, it's Jonestown Survivor is the name of the book. And I'm going to give you guys the link to the website that is her. It has her bio there. It has the book there. Obviously, it's available on Amazon. I'll give you guys a link to buy it. I'll give you guys a couple other links for reference. But let's get straight to it with my guest, Laura Johnston Cole. First of all, how are you tonight, Laura?
I'm really good. I'm on the West Coast, and we actually had a huge event up in San Francisco and Oakland on the 40th anniversary. So, you know, I felt really good that I was meeting back up with my good friends. And so I'd say that things are really good, and I feel really in touch with a lot of people that I love very much.
Well, and you know, that's the interesting thing about this, and something that came out in the interviews that you and I have done a couple of interviews in the past. I think the first one was in 2014, and quite honestly, it sticks with me every time I speak with you, because it is extremely moving. I see that there was a lot of motivations here that were not necessarily about. Well, look, let me be. Let me be blunt, and let me just sound rude for a moment. Let's tell the truth about what it is that people say. regarding the massacre at Jonestown. Again, I'm not going to call it a ritual suicide or any of that stuff because I am not satisfied that that's what occurred there. But I'm going to tell you that generally it's become something that a lot of people make reference to and have little understanding of. And they talk about people that are under mind control and people that mindlessly support a maniacal leader. Now, I'm not saying that Jim Jones was not maniacal. I am simply saying that this is not a simple case of just the gullible being sucked into something because they just needed the grand leader. There was a lot of things going on there. And you uniquely present this, in my estimation, because you were actually a part of what they called the planning commission regarding the Jonestown settlement and all of that, weren't you?
Yeah, I joined People Simple in 1970, and within about 2 years, I was part of what was called the Planning Commission. That's kind of a joke for a name, because the reality is Jim did most of the planning. He certainly made all the decisions, and he, you know, created the timeline. So we were there. It's almost like we were there as token, kitchen cabinets. But the reality is we had very little power. I think that he worked really hard to figure out how he could drive a wedge between different people. He certainly did it with people on his, you know, his group of mistresses and secretaries. I think that he was really astute at figuring out how to not allow people to form alliances with each other when he was in the midst. He wanted to have everybody's relationship with him. So one of the things he did is have a planning commission that picked some people rather than others, which wasn't necessarily because of hard work or, you know, good deeds or dedication. Sometimes it was he would pick people on the planning commission because he needed to watch them and he felt like he wanted them closer at hand. So within the group community, people who weren't selected somehow thought they were slighted, or some people felt that way. So it's an interesting, it was an interesting experiment he did with that.
Well, let's back up just a second because, you know, you're involved, you joined the People's Temple. Okay, let me ask you the biggest question that probably a lot of people would ask and never bother to get to asking because they get so stuck on, well, gee, you know, how many mistresses did Jones have and what was his control like and all that and the Svengali kind of thing. Look, let's get into the personal end of this because I think this is the most interesting part of it and the most necessary part of the story to be told, because I believe this needs to be out there as a warning, quite honestly, that you need to be at all times vigilant regarding your motivations and what it is you do. And I don't mean you, Laura. I do mean the listener. You have learned, but I mean there's something to this. You went into this with an idea. You wanted to do something. It wasn't just a religious, in air quotes, cult. It was a lot of things rolled into one. There was a socially active aspect to this that is kind of left out of the equation by most people that talk about this, in my estimation. And so I ask you, what is it that got you motivated to join and to become part of this? I mean, was it because of, you know, just, well, I saw a bright light one day and decided Jim Jones was God? Or was there something about this that was a big, like a draw, something that made sense to you? Could you tell us about that?
Well, the most interesting part of that question is that you really said it when you did the introduction, that there's a, looking back at anniversaries, 50 years ago, you know, five of our leaders in the country, or five of the people who had proven that they had character and wanted to make things better, they were all killed in our country. In the 1960s, John Kennedy, Bobby Kennedy, Martin Luther King, Malcolm X, Medgar Evers, and really a lot of other people who were in leadership were killed or gunned down or imprisoned, like Bobby Seale, or they were gotten out of the way so that the mainstream, the white, privileged people could continue to make decisions. So in the 1960s, we saw vigilantism take over by just murdering people that they didn't think we were going to follow the, you know, follow the script. So when I joined People's Temple, it was after those five people had died, had been killed, murdered. And it was a time when we were in the war in Vietnam. We had Kent State murders where, you know, somehow National Guardsmen shot our own youth at a college campus. And so all of that created this historical kind of mess that we had to respond to and figure out what to do. So as I grew up in the 1960s and 70s, I was in high school and college, and I went to Woodstock thinking, well, maybe if I stayed stoned, I wouldn't realize what a terrible state our country was in. Or I also worked with the Black Panthers for about 6 months, providing free breakfast for kids who would otherwise probably not had a free breakfast, but would not have been mentored by the men in their community the same way. Mm-hmm. So I tried to figure out, looking at our society, looking at what was going on in history, we were trying to fight to move forward after the, you know, Eisenhower era of not making progress, really. We had a couple of laws passed and Supreme Court decisions with Brown versus the Board of Education, but it was really tedious work. And so by the 1970s, when I first joined People's Temple in March of 1970, I didn't know really who to call upon or where to start working to make the world better. And then I came across Jim Jones. Mm. So in a way, that satisfied everything that I had going because he already had an integrated community, which really I've been looking for, you know, even since then, to find a community as diverse as the People's Temple community.
See, I count Larry Pinckney as one of my friends who was a Black Panther at that time. And I all the time discuss the fact that there was a decapitation of the leadership of progressive thought and the silencing of many a voice who had a great pulpit from the time Medgar Evers was killed to the time John F. Kennedy was killed, again, citing all the very same people over that very, very tight five-year time period where this did set the country on a different trajectory. Given the fact that we had gone into Vietnam and there was that contentious issue, given the fact that civil rights workers had been murdered in various parts of the country, the Mississippi burning case, for example, other civil rights activists had been harassed, either killed or nearly killed in various places. And the response was from the people at the time, a lot of them, sure, they gave up. But a great many people wanted to improve things. It's a funny thing. The Black Panthers, according to Larry, started really because they wanted to put a traffic signal in, you know, and that's that's pretty interesting coming from what that organization became, and watching the establishment react to it was something also remarkable. You know, we ended up with the President Nixon, which I guarantee you we wouldn't have had without the assassination of Bobby Kennedy. We ended up with a great many different changes in this country's face, if you will, as far as the world was concerned because of this time period. And given all of that, it's interesting. You had an idea that you wanted to look, I know it's dangerous to do it, but I want to be part of the solution, not surrender to what seems to be the program of the establishment to crush everybody who is not going right along with the program, you know, the way the old days were. It's very interesting that this is really what probably brought you to Jones, because he was somebody who was also doing some of this activism. Now, the motives for it, maybe people want to question and debate and discuss today, but the fact is what you saw is an organization that could literally be part of the solution, that was willing to help people in its community, so on and so forth. And you probably had yourself on a couple of interesting governmental lists out there. I'm sure J. Edgar Hoover had your name on somewhere, just because you associated with these people, you know. and the Black Panthers, I mean, please, terms like neutralize, you know, they get out of their FBI files when they file a Freedom of Information Act. They wanted them neutralized, which means either in jail or dead. And, well, they succeeded with that through the COINTEL program. So, but meanwhile, this is really the motive as far as you're concerned, and you weren't the only one. I mean, I know that for a fact. Would you say that I'm misinformed here?
Oh, no, I think that that's totally true, but I had another thought about what you were just saying in a way that actually there were kind of three things going on simultaneously. First was, you know, Jim Jones from day one was seeking power. So he decided to just do it through churches because that seemed to him to be the most worshipful pose for people who followed him to have. So it was convenient for him to be in the trappings of a religious person. So that's one. So first of all, here's Jim Jones who from day one wanted to access power. So the other thing is who took over leadership when our society had decided, okay, let's condemn John Kennedy, Bobby Kennedy, Martin Luther King, Medgar Evers, Malcolm X, all these people. Who should we have in power? And in a way, Jim was the perfect person because whether you're looking at the San Francisco, you know, powers that be or the state of California or wherever it would go from there, you have a man who was white who seemed to be, you know, appeared to be, his public persona was a religious man. So already he was somebody who may feel that he at least shared the spotlight with God, if not, you know, part of, you know, the God work. But anyway, he was somebody who, in a way, was thought to be more predictable and more a person of privilege, not somebody who was in the trenches, and certainly not the Black Panthers or the American Indian movement with Dennis Banks or Cesar Chavez. So he was somebody who was white, had some money, had a lot of parishioners who were mixed, seemed to be able to rattle off a philosophy of some sort that made people come. But he was picked more not just by his own essence and being, but because people thought he would be a safe leader to kind of voice a different point of view but still be controllable. So Jim Jones fit the perfect profile of somebody who could be given some authority so that they could say, oh, yeah, we are doing something. We are acknowledging this point of view, but we're not going to have, you know, we're not going to have Huey Newton on the Housing Commission of San Francisco. We're not going to have Dennis Banks. We're not going to have these people. We'll pick white Jim Jones and then say we're doing something. So he was the perfect, in a way, he was kind of a tool of the powers that be because they didn't know him well enough, but they thought because he was white, he was safe.
Well, in an interesting way, he also presented himself very well as somebody who was walking the walk while he was talking the talk when it came to being, you know, racially inclusive. He had been on the Human Rights Commission, you know, previous to going to California. He had been, you know, he had adopted several children, not white children, by the way. The son he named Jim Jones Jr., in fact, is African American. The a couple of the other kids, I believe, are Asian. You know, and he literally called them, you know, the Rainbow Family, and that's really what it looked like. You know, here we go. He was like that, but also his works from the church seemed to be doing things in the community as well. It's not like there was just a lot of rhetoric and nothing behind it. It did appear as though you had somebody who was very progressive, but also a safe sort of man of God kind of, you know, face front. And, but, you know, we would learn later about a lot of other things. But the fact is that at a time of a perilous sort of positioning for somebody who believes in these things very strongly and sees them under attack by either local tyrants in various municipalities throughout the country or by the federal government itself. And it's clearly under fire by assassins, given the fact that everybody who sticks up their head, you know, against the Vietnam War caught a bullet if they had enough of an audience. I mean, I'm being very nasty about this, but I mean, this is the truth of it. It seemed to be a very good vehicle for a lot of things and was attractive to somebody who had these inclinations, right?
Right. That's exactly right. He fooled us all. And I think that, you know, looking back at Jim Jones and studying him, I do feel like, you know, his number one priority always was to become powerful and to not have any competition in any of his areas of expertise. So in his ministry or his healings or his politics, he didn't want any kind of a contest going on. And second to that, I mean, he did love his children. He did adopt children. He and his wife were the first white couple to adopt a black family, a black son in Indiana, so in the whole state of Indiana. So there were things that he did along the way that were remarkable. And if we hadn't a clue of what was going on in his mind, and if he hadn't then killed 917 other people, it's possible we'd look at that into more depth and kind of find out who the real Jim Jones is or was. Mm. But we did find out who the real Jim Jones was, and he was the person who thought life could not go on without him micromanaging every aspect of our lives, and he didn't want to share the spotlight. He didn't want to share the glory or infamy with anybody else. It was going to be all Jim Jones from day one. And so we did learn that, you know, horrifyingly, but he hid it for a long time. But there was that part of him that, you know, he was good to his sons until the end when he got drug addicted and sick and, you know, was powerless in the middle of Jonestown to do what he wanted.
Well, right. I mean, even Jim Jones Jr., the child we were just talking about, the African American he had adopted and named after himself, so therefore, you know, not a matter of ego and not something that was simply done for show. I mean, even he states to this day that he was well educated, well taken care of, you know, so on and so forth. And he simultaneously has stated publicly that he both loves and hates the man that was Jim Jones.
Right.
And this is the thing, is it not possible that there was two legitimate edges to this blade, or is it or was it really this elaborate kind of thing that had nothing to do with anything else other than power? I guess that's one of those debates for historians to continue to wrestle over. Just like the number of deaths, quite honestly, you know, the counting of the bodies, if you will, I still see that being reported in with variations, as if not everyone is fully accounted for, regarding that situation. I mean, it's a very tangled, messy, horrific thing that, that this all, you know, ended up in. But unfortunately, like I said, it had a start in a slightly different place. And I'd like to talk to you about that a bit, because, again, since you're part of the Planning Commission, not saying that you wielded a lot of power or anything, but you knew about how the Jonestown settlement, if you will, was set up, didn't you?
Oh, sure. I knew. You know, I think that there was a need to know within People's Temple, and if you were one of the intimate secretaries and mistresses, you knew a certain aspect of, you know, kind of maybe Jim's strategy on divide and conquer, maybe Jim's strategy on keeping the population in Jonestown paranoid and afraid of the outsiders. And I mean, I think that no matter what your position, you likely had insight into a particular area. And on the Planning Commission, even though we didn't meet much in Jonestown because there was no, you know, private place to meet, most of our Planning Commission meetings were in both Redwood Valley and San Francisco and Los Angeles before we moved to Guyana. Once we got to Guyana, there was a different crew that met with Jim as kind of a kitchen cabinet that had to do with department heads and piggery heads and the medical offices and things. So I think that Jim felt comfortable moving leadership around like that. He even had some people who were mistresses at one time then become, you know, farm workers and had other people move into the slots. So I think that in a way that was a threat he held over anybody. If you got too, if you associated too much with someone other than him, if you started asking questions that seemed to him to promote fact-finding when he was the one in charge of all the facts, there were certain things that I think he tried to let you know that it's not going to be appropriate if you think that all of a sudden you can question me or talk behind my back or associate with somebody and have private conversations. So I think he created groups where he could get to know us better and where he could get more work out of us. And then he would move on as necessary when people didn't live up to what he had asked of them. So I'm not sure if that answered your question, but I think that what he did always is he had a kind of kitchen cabinet where he would run his ideas through, kind of clean them up, and then he would present everything as his own idea.
Well, there was an advance crew, which I want to ask you about, that went out to begin the work to sort of set up things there. Because, I mean, there was an area in the jungle that at one time had been occupied by a different religious organization that I believe Jonestown was built on. Before we get into that, I also want to make the live listeners aware that if you're in the chat room at my website or if you're on Twitter, if you enter a reasonable question, I will bring it into the conversation. If you have any questions for Laura Johnston Cole, right now is the time. I'll let you interact with her in that way. I will filter what it is you say, but you have to simply send the message on Twitter or at the chat room, and I will enter it into the conversation. Now, I tweeted that out beforehand, so I do have a message already asking a question, listening to the conversation. It's kind of a logical question, but, you know, you mentioned the word mistress a few times, Elsa asks, and she wants to know, were you one of the mistresses / secretaries you keep mentioning?
Yeah, no, I was not one, and I really feel I'm so fortunate that didn't work for me. Jim Jones would always kind of lay in wait for people to turn one day plus 18 years old. And so he really preferred very young, virginal white women. And so by the time I came to People's Temple and had been, you know, through everything I'd been through, including living with the Black Panthers and, I mean, every other possible mistake that I could make, that was no longer anything that I could, talk about. Can I just change one thing that you said, though, just to clarify it?
Sure.
You said that People's Temple was built on another religious community, but that's not true. When we built Jonestown, it was from ground up in the middle of the rainforest. There had never been anything else in that area other than paths for the Amerindians who lived in the area to cross across the, you know, the expanse of the rainforest. So there was never anything else before that. There was a community in Matthews Ridge which was the largest airport close to Guyana, to Jonestown. It was about 30 miles by a really crummy road. And there was another religious group that was there, another cult that, I never had contact with. It's remotely possible that Jim had some contact with there, but usually when Jim had contact with another church, whether it was Father Divine or the Edgar Casey study group or whatever, he was trying to take membership into his own church. So if he ever had contact with the other cult, which had a very strong leader also, it probably was to try and see if he could get some of their members to join People's Temple. But that never happened. We never had any other, like, North American religious group come into Jonestown to join.
Oh, no. Yeah, no, I wasn't suggesting that. It's just I was under this impression that the actual land that Jonestown was on was at one time owned by and being used by another church.
No.
But that could be just a misunderstanding of mine, something I was reading. I did a quick little extra study before the show tonight, and that was one of those things that I just kind of passed by, and somebody else might have inaccurately reported that, that I was reading about, you know, the story. But I do know that there was at least one other type of cult that was in proximity, as in it's, yes, the same country. But I was under the impression that that property was actually owned by another religious organization before. But I didn't know that you guys actually went in there. And this leads right into this question about the advance team, because there was a team that went in. Now, this is sometime in 76 or 77 that a team of guys went in there to begin doing the work, right?
Yeah, in 1975, we had the very first crew of 12 or so people. By the time I came down in March of 1977, there were about 30 or 35 people who worked full-time in Jonestown, clearing roads, leveling the grounds, knocking down the trees and the bush, and kind of setting it up for the community. Okay. So it started in 1975, and in fact, the Planning Commission went down for Christmas in 1975. 100 of us flew down over Christmas to look at the area and see what Jonestown was going to look like.
Okay. Yeah, see, I was under the understanding that a lot of work went on in 76, but I didn't know it had started in 75. See, that's the thing. There's a lot of little facts here and factoids that are out there that are not necessarily true. That's why it's great to talk to somebody who actually knows. Anyway, and here's the thing. So this is going on. What was the pitch here? I mean, was it just about literally we're going to get away from the people that are harassing us here, and we're going to begin a sub-country of sorts? I mean, is this going to be something? Because I know that the Guyanese government really did not want to interfere with somebody like Jones, who was on their property, basically, in their country. was it just really to get away from the peering eyes of reporters? Because that's another thing people often say, that it was these people that started writing these news stories and started doing investigative journalism that inspired the creation of Jonestown. Do you think that was the motivation, or was there, well, in fact, what was the motivation, and what do you have to say about that idea?
I think that a lot of the people who joined People's Temple, like I did, who were like, you know, had some college, had jobs, and, you know, had been looking for a way to interact in the community, making it better. We moved to Jonestown thinking it was a fresh start where we could create a utopian community, and then we could be a role model for the world. And so that was always my thinking, that we had everything going. We had a totally diverse group of people. I mean, it's hard to express. When I talk about diverse, you know, sometimes we're talking about, you know, I live on a street that's diverse. And so I have on my street people who are white, people who are young, people who are old, people who are Hispanic, people who are black, people who are Muslim. So we have all of that on my street where I live right now. In People's Temple, we had all of that, but we treated each other like brothers and sisters. So we're not talking about diverse at a distance. We're talking about absolutely thinking that these were the same people we were going to live our whole lives with. Do you know what I mean? Like, there's such a difference in quality of relationships. We weren't neighbors who, you know, you could borrow sugar from. We were neighbors who would take care of your babies if you had to run to the hospital. We were neighbors who I would take your son into my home so I could raise him and tutor him because I'm a teacher. I mean, we had the kinds of relationships that, you know, were the best because we were people who wanted to be part of one family, one rainbow family. And so it was very different from what we call diversity at a distance, you know, people who are my friends and I might see them once a week at a meeting, or you might see them at church, or you might see them like that. This was a different kind of a family. So that's what I wanted. That's what I wanted in Jonestown. Mm. There was also another thing, though, because if we look again at the history of, you know, Martin Luther King, who, you know, had a dream in 1963, and by 1967, he said, you know, his dream has turned into a nightmare. We had people who lived in the society who saw the struggle every day to get jobs, to get representation, to vote, to get good educations in a public school setting, to get, you know, to appear before a judge and be treated equally with somebody who was white, to get legal representation. We saw, had people who saw all these injustices on a daily basis, and they said, you know, why would I stay here? Why would I stay in San Francisco or Los Angeles or Redwood Valley when I could move to a place where it's racism-free? So I am, you know, I could never say People's Temple was racism-free. Obviously, Jim's mistresses were all white. Obviously, his mistresses all had a lot to say about what was going on around him, them, and their voices were more powerful than the rest of us. So it was not true that People's Temple was not racist. Jim was racist in his selection of mistresses and secretaries, no question about it. If you look at the larger society, there racism is rampant. And so within the community, say, take aside Jim's 20 people who were the upper echelon, who were mostly white, the rest of the people in Guyana, we all worked hard. It didn't matter what color you were. Everybody had a job. Everybody who was illiterate got educated. Everybody who was sick got to see a doctor. A doctor, a nurse got on medication. Even in Jonestown, people who were diabetic and had to have special diets, 1,000 people in the middle of a rainforest had 3 meals a day and all the medication that they needed to monitor their heart, you know, their blood pressure and diabetes and whatever else. So even, you know, accepting that People's Temple was not racism-free because Jim created the racism at the top, the rest of us who lived in the community, who sat and had lunch, breakfast, lunch, and dinner together, who showered together in the male or female showers or sat together during our meetings, it was a community that we all helped promote the next person to be the best they could be. And the result was we had people who got out of prison who had been dysfunctional or drug addicts before, and when they got out of prison, they could be a head of a department like the piggery or a head of the department like, you know, landscape or something like that. So we were in a place where people could actually flourish with their natural skills. And people who were maybe kind of sheltered workshop kinds of people found enough support to be the best that they've been in their lives. And I can name quite a few people who were in Jonestown who for the year or two that they lived there, they were doing the best jobs and they were the most responsible they'd been in their lives. So we had that all around us, working for us.
Right. Now, I've just been I got a message from a British listener who, or should I say not a British listener, but someone listening in the UK, how about we'll just say that, someone listening in the UK who had never actually heard of what happened in Jonestown before this broadcast. Now, it's interesting. I want to go back over a couple of things here really quickly that I wasn't going to cover, because we're talking about the setup of this community right now. And I wanted to get into that because you really hear a lot of these other things elsewhere. But Jim Jones, effectively in Indiana, was quite the charismatic sort of preacher. In the Pentecostal sense, at one time you'll find out interesting facts like he even sold monkeys to people in order to make a living at one point.
And got members that way. Some members who even were with us in Jonestown joined because Jim went to their door trying to sell a monkey.
Yeah, he would go door to door selling monkeys to people. I'm not kidding. That's right. He would import them from other countries and sell them. And he has an interesting story in and of himself, and I urge you to take a look at a biography of Jim Jones to get a handle on that. But I didn't want to go deep into focus on him. However, this situation was that about 1,000 people end up in Jonestown in Guyana, which is a part of South America. Okay. You can look to where it is and exactly where it is in relation to other countries on a map if you like. A lot of interesting, context there as to where that country is. But put that aside. It was to be settled as a independent, like standing commune for people to come together. And Jones was being kind of pursued by people that were looking into these practices, family members complaining that some of their families were sort of sucked into this cult. And this guy's a cult leader, even though he had been an activist, on many levels, assisting people locally in California after he moved from Indianapolis. Or from Indiana, I should say. I think it was Indianapolis, though, directly.
Yeah.
Or a suburb of it. Either way, you can, again, go to his biography. But what's interesting here is that after this goes on, and this is in, 77, I would say, when the thing really got full swing, as Laura just revealed to us, they started work on it in 1975. But what happened on November 18th, 1978, is the reason that that we have to recognize this, because what it culminated in is, first off, the assassination of a congressman and the murder of other individuals who had gone down there to investigate, including an NBC News crew. One cameraman even famously was filming at the time he was murdered. And things like that. They were attacked upon attempting to leave Jonestown after going to board airplanes and taking some Jonestown members who wished to leave, according to the story, with them. And they were attacked by other members of Jones' congregation. After this was reported to him, he had a quite a reaction and gathered everyone together in the pavilion. And then the accounts get very, very muddy. Quite honestly, most people for the majority of my life have talked about it as the largest mass suicide on record. But if one digs a little bit, and even the mainstream media today is even beginning to acknowledge the fact that that is not a clear explanation of what occurred, that there were people that were indeed murdered, and it is unknown exactly what happened to a lot of them, except that more than 900 people died in one day. And a great many of them died as a result of the poisoned Kool-Aid, or not necessarily Kool-Aid the brand name, but a Kool-Aid type drink. Purple stuff, apparently. And it was mixed with cyanide. But Jim Jones himself died of a gunshot wound to the head, to the temple. It is still unclear as to whether it was self-inflicted or someone else did it. I suspect someone else did it, but there are very few survivors. I'm talking to somebody who was there, who was involved in the initiation of the community, and also happened to just be in the right place to survive that day that Jones did indeed order his followers to commit suicide. And we're going to get to that part of the story in the second hour, I promise you, but it's still something that is not clearly and fully understood and is still being reckoned with, not only by the survivors, but also by outside observers who do not necessarily recognize the full implications of what occurred here. Also, Jones has been cited several times as possibly being someone who was part of CIA operations, who might have been either someone involved in mind control, MK Ultra type experiments, or was a subject of it and therefore had gone out and done the dirty work, or had conducted Jonestown entirely as an experiment. Things like this are discussed often. I'm not going off into that direction because I'm actually talking to a firsthand witness who was involved. And I want her perspective, and if she wants to offer anything on any of what I just said, I mean, we're going to go there. But I just want to give you guys a capsule in case it is something that you'd never heard of. Because, as I said, one person in the UK had not. And you know what? I think that's a fair sort of summation of why it is we're having this discussion. Because, honestly, had there not been the mass murder of 900 people, this might not be something that people were studying as they do, or misunderstanding, misrepresenting, or even noticing. on the planet had this, gone some other way, Laura. What do you think?
Well, I mean, I think that that's good. When I try and explain about People's Temple, what I find works for me best is I kind of go by calendar. I mean, to me, it organizes in my mind. You know, Jim and Marceline married in 1950. They adopted a total of 5 or 6 kids from other nationalities, had one of their own homegrown kids. In 1966, they moved out to California, and Jim said it was to be in a safe place, but in any case, they left Indiana, where it was the Bible Belt, where Jim had gone to 5 or 6 different churches. So he went to Pentecostal tent healings. He went to just different churches, and he finally ended up with the Disciples of Christ. He and 100 people came out to California in the late 60s. He picked up some people who were kind of the new, I don't know, bourgeois, or the new not inner city people who had to worry about electricity bills. He picked up an Edgar Cayce study group. He had quite a few people join from Berkeley who dropped out of Berkeley and decided they wanted to be part of a progressive movement. He had some people in a community in Northern California join. So at the point that he got to California, in a way, the group was more diverse than ever. And so in 1970, he built a temple in Northern California, 2 hours north of San Francisco. Then he moved to San Francisco, and he created a place where 10,000 people might come over a month. So there were people living in Redwood Valley, people in San Francisco. We went to Los Angeles every other week. So it continued to get bigger and bigger based on a healing ministry that he manipulated, and also because he had, in a way, the best chance for family members to get help. If they were in prison, attorneys and people like me wrote letters to get them out of prison. If they were sick, we had nurses and doctors to make sure they got good medical care. If they were impoverished and didn't have housing, they would be put into dorms or put into communes where people could share resources. So we had things that would make a community tight-knit and also have their needs taken care of. And then in 1973 or 74, one of our young people died of a drug overdose, a heroin overdose, or some kind of a poison overdose. And so at that point, we started thinking, okay, we have everything going for us here, and yet we can't protect our children. Let's see what are some of our choices. And we started looking for a place out of the country to create the community. So whether that was a bogus issue and wasn't really the issue or not, I don't really know. I do know that Jim wanted power, and that really in the middle of San Francisco, there were many eyes, and he was not able to rule as one powerful leader without having a lot of questions and media types and people coming to check him out and things like that. So I think that he felt, you know, I want to be in a place more remote. I'd like to move out of kind of the spotlight and be someplace where I am really in charge. So he found Guyana, that he had visited in the 60s. They had a socialist government. They were delighted that somebody, a powerful, you know, United States group with a lot of money, millions of dollars, would be able to invest it in building a free medical clinic in an area that was a contested area between Guyana and Venezuela. Because Guyana and Venezuela had a border treaty saying that if Guyana could populate a certain area of its Northwest District, then Venezuela would walk away. But if Guyana couldn't populate it, then that area was in dispute and Venezuela would like to take it back. So the government of Guyana said, okay, we have this rich church. They want to have a free medical clinic. They're looking for a remote site. They don't want our constant supervision or interference. Where can we put it? Aha, we'll put it right there on the border. We'll take care of the population. We'll have a free clinic. We'll give them remoteness, and everything will be fine, and some of their money will be dispersed in our country that is having a tough time paying off IMF loans. So we moved to Guyana. Everything was, you know, remote, very hard to get to. The capital was 24 hours by boat. And then in 1977, investigators in San Francisco and in the Bay Area in California and the concerned relatives, people who had family members in Guyana, and people who left from Guyana, including two of Jim's top aides, Debbie Layton, who wrote her book, and Terry Buford, who also wrote a book, who just died this last week. All these people were coming public and talking to the news media and talking to Congress, getting their speeches put in the congressional record. And so all of a sudden, Jim was exposed again. And so they found that he had been, you know, busted in a sting operation in Los Angeles in 72. Apparently there was one I didn't know about from Indiana, that he had been involved in a sting operation, or he was arrested on some illicit sex issue in Indiana or in Brazil, I'm not sure. But anyway, he was no longer undercover. He was no longer remote enough to stay out of people's way. And then the congressman, Leo Ryan, was contacted by this concerned relatives and Jim's former mistresses and other people in the community to say, you know what, Jim Jones is doing things in Jonestown. We don't know what it is, but we think our relatives want to leave and he won't let them leave. So all of that going on happened at a time where Jim was strung out on drugs. He was physically sick with some kind of a brain infection. He was under house arrest kind of in Jonestown, 24 hours by boat from Georgetown, because the Guyanese government had 9 claims that he was holding people against their will, and he didn't have papers to have children who were under 18. He didn't have the proper authorization to take them to Guyana in the first place. So there were 9 pending claims in the courts in Guyana to say Jim Jones didn't have couldn't keep their kids there. He didn't have the paperwork. So all of this happened, and in a way, maybe the biggest thing, although I'm not sure, Jim had planned that Jonestown was going to be 600 people. The community was going to live, and with 600 people and being very careful about food and planting and planning and money, that would work. He already had 1,000 people there that he had to feed 3 times a day, and the Jonestown community would never be self-sufficient. So that was something he did not know. He could have known, but he didn't. There were people who knew at the time. People back in the States knew that rainforest soil was not going to, you know, create enough vegetation to feed 1,000 people 3 meals a day. But in any case, he found all that out during the summer of 1978. And there was no getting out because the congressman insisted on coming down. So he was stuck with all of that going on. He did everything he could to keep Congressman Ryan from coming and to clean things up. He brought everybody down right away, everybody he could bring down right away, because he was afraid there might be a bad reputation about Jonestown, and he wanted to get as many people there as possible. But really, at the end of the summer of 1978, there was like lose-lose. There was nothing about the community that was going to be easy. And the Russians said, no, we couldn't come there. Cuba said, no, we couldn't go there. So his possible opportunities to go to other countries were being turned down. So there he was, kind of stuck in the middle of all of that. And then Congressman Ryan came, and, you know, 20 people or so said they wanted to leave and go back with Congressman Ryan.
Right, right. Now, here is where, of course, the story gets a little stranger. And somebody did ask a question regarding the Ryan incident already, as well as another question. I'm not sure what order to put these in, but let's just put them in. First of all, somebody asked basically what they've seen in documentaries that Jones utilized sex as a control mechanism over a lot of his followers. Now, since you weren't one of them, do you know what that means, and what does that mean in context with the males as well as the females? Was he having sex with both, or was he controlling sexual activity? What was the exact nature of that? Do you know? That's one thing.
I do know. Okay. I do know that. Basically, I think that in Jonestown or in all of People's Temple, it's likely Jim had sex with 30 or more men and women in People's Temple over the years. And usually it would be with somebody who was like 18 and a day old if he had his choice. He also set up sex between some of his lieutenants, some of his secretaries, and other people who wanted to share Jim's power. So he absolutely used sex as a tool and also felt free to have sex and then blame the victim. So one of the things he would do is he might have sex with somebody and then he'd be public and he'd say, I had to have sex with this person. She thought she wasn't beautiful. And so I had to tell her, yes, you are beautiful, and then have sex with her. So he was the kind of a predator who would first figure out some way to manipulate the person into sex and then blame the victim for being insecure. So, you know what I mean? Really just foundationally, he was not a kind man. He was a manipulator and he used sex every way he could because he was more powerful the more strings he had attaching him to different members. So,
everything from actually utilizing it directly to bartering in it and saying, you know, listen, if you do my bidding effectively, I've got a little reward for you, and here it is, because people
That's
will
right.
follow my commands as well. So looks to me like he came at the sexual angle from pretty much every direction to utilize it to manipulate and maintain his hold over his followers. Is that an accurate statement?
You know, I think that, first of all, he wanted to be in on all the sex acts. So it's not like he would delegate too many people to have sex. I mean, I think if there were some people that he was really not interested in having sex with, he might arrange some kind of a tryst for those people. But the bottom line is he wanted to have sex. He wanted to have everything when he wanted it. He wanted to have sex when he wanted it, with whom he wanted it. He wanted to have drugs when he wanted them, and so he did that. And then his secretaries and mistresses had to monitor that. Whatever he wanted, he wanted it on his time, on his decision. Mm-hmm. So sex was just one more thing. I personally feel that he used sex for power. Mm-hmm. And so I do not think he was really a sex addict. I think he was always, like I said before, from day one, a power addict. And if he had sex with you, then he would feel that you would be more kindly towards him, you would be more understanding. Whatever he thought was going to happen, I think he would plan to use that you had sex with him, you know, as a way. And if, you know, you didn't behave, then he'd bring it up saying, you know, I tried to tell her she was beautiful, but now she's acting out. Or, you know what I mean? He would just use that. He would use anything possible to try and manipulate you into being subservient.
Right. And, you know, and again, from all angles, right? I mean, he utilized family members against one another, not necessarily in a sec, you know, getting away from the sexual topic for a second, but I mean, there's even these reports about, beatings and, you know, punishments being issued. He would make the families meet them out sometimes and, this kind of thing. And, it was, very, very, very interesting to take a look at this sort of multifaceted control system that he was using. Again, very, very dark subject matter. You know, I realize, and some people might, you know, be a little taken aback by it, but the truth is, this is the truth, and actually it's probably a lot deeper and darker than we're really going here. But You're being very gracious in answering these questions. I want to let you know I appreciate that. The next thing is that somebody asked about Deborah Layton, and I'm going to go to a break after I ask you this question. And then I want to get into, you know, some very personal things. I want to really get into your point of view about this in the next hour. But the question reads as follows. I read somewhere that Larry Layton was one of the shooters when Congressman Ryan was killed. Is that any relation to Deborah Layton, and could you explain that?
Yeah, I think that the story of the Layton family is a terrible tragedy. So Lisa Layton was Larry and Debbie's mother, and she died of cancer in Jonestown. So as like right now, I am going through cancer therapy. And so I know that I have to be at my, you know, at the office 10 days in a row for shots and 4 days in a row for chemotherapy. So to be in the most remote part of South America fighting cancer, where we did not have things like chemotherapy and radiation and stuff, I just think it must have been totally excruciating for her kids to watch that. So that's one thing. First of all, the mother died of cancer in this remote village. So then Debbie Layton left, and she, you know, had been involved with the money part of People's Temple and organizing and collections. So she had a lot of information about where the money was, what banks were used, and all that. So then she left. Actually, it starts before then. First, I'm sorry, I do have to backtrack. First, Larry Layton and Carolyn Layton joined People's Temple. Pretty soon after that, Jim Jones took Carolyn Layton to be his longtime mistress. So from 1968, probably, until the last day in Jonestown, Jim Jones' primary mistress was Carolyn Layton, Larry's first wife. Then Larry and Carolyn were divorced, and Larry married a second person, Karen Layton, who then became one of Jim's secretaries and mistresses. So from the very beginning, Larry had, you know, like two strikes against him trying to figure out what's his role. And Jim was as abusive as he could possibly be. The Layton family was a Jewish family. They had, you know, some of them had survived the Holocaust. They have a tragic path anyway, a tragic past. And then they came to Guyana, and then these horrific things happened. So Debbie Layton left in May, and then by the time November came around, Larry was there on his own. His wife, you know, was, you know, spoken of derogatorily all the time, and that's only in public and probably in private too. Jim probably never let up talking about Debbie. And so here's Larry trying to figure out, well, what's his role? And Jim added him to the group of people who were going to the airstrip to kill Congressman Ryan. So Larry went to the airstrip. He said he was a defector and he was leaving, but actually he was there to fire the gun. He did not shoot Congressman Ryan. He did not wound Congressman Ryan, but he was at the airstrip with a gun, and he did wound some other people. And so when everything settled and they were looking for somebody to be the bad guy or the person who could, you know, be held, everything could be held against him, he was charged with conspiracy to murder the congressman, and he served 18 years in prison. So he served it in both Guyana and then back here in the United States. So, I mean, their family was just, like, tortured from day one. Mm. And so Larry did go. He did not kill the congressman, though. And so, but he was put in prison for 18 years. So, you know, and he served his time and then got out. But, I mean, it's just really, the tragedy of the Layton family, in a way, speaks so much about the way Jim handled business,
right?
Which is, if there's a horse that's down or dog that's down or whatever, kick whatever is down. Never let somebody feel that breath of freedom, you know? And so he would target people, and it wasn't always in public. Like, I didn't even know that Carolyn was Jim's mistress. I know I'm totally, you know, in a haze about it, but the reality is I did not know. Most people, I think, in the congregation didn't know, although I could be wrong. But so, I mean, a lot of this was behind the scenes, but looking back at it, knowing what I know now, I think that Jim just targeted people who, you know, were just at the wrong place at the wrong time and just went out of his way to make sure their lives were miserable. And he did that with the Layton family.
Well, yeah, but first of all, there's a lot of misery to be told here, and there are, look, when you got 900 bodies, you know, I'm telling the listeners this, obviously, when you've got 900 bodies, there's probably about 10,000 tragedies that could be told.
That's exactly right.
Given the destruction to people's families, people's lives, the individuals who did care. As I said, there were something like 200 bodies that were never even claimed. But you know, that does say that there were 700 that were. So 700 people had to be claimed. And how many families were destroyed, irrevocably altered and damaged? How many other lives were actually wrecked? And meanwhile, there were other bodies, too, because actually one of the most horrific things that really just about brought me to tears the last time you and I spoke was a discussion about what happened, because you weren't there the day that this occurred. You were in Georgetown, which is the capital city. And, well, as you said, it would take, what, 24 hours by boat to get to there?
Yeah. And that was the way we generally traveled. I had a question, though. When you say the bodies were not claimed, what do you mean by that? Do you mean identified?
Oh, no, not that they weren't identified, but there's a mass burial in San Francisco, I think, where...
In Oakland, California, where we had the ceremony on the 18th. So there are 450 bodies buried, but, you know... You know, what happened on November 18th is you're in the tropics, right?
Right.
90 or 100 degrees tropics. So on November 18th, a Saturday, everybody died. 918 people died. On the next day, Sunday, some people went out and they found it. They discovered it. They kind of looked around, but they didn't. There was no way to identify people. There was no one there to identify people. So the day after that, or Monday or Tuesday, they had some of the survivors from the house where I was go out to Jonestown, and they put toe tags on the bodies to identify them. And then there was a horrible rainstorm. And so everything that was put on the toe tags was washed off. So you had in Jonestown 909 bodies that had been in the tropics for, at this time, almost nearly a week, right, with very few people who could recognize people because everybody had died. And so, you know, it's not like you could say, okay, and here's the 917th name. In the tropics, 24 hours by boat, there was no way to handle it like a medical office or a coroner's office where everybody was identified. Nobody had purses. Nobody had, you know, nobody would carry their passports and stuff. There was no way to identify many of the people. So some people did try and find their loved ones and try and do genetic testing and stuff, but it was like an almost impossible effort considering you were in the middle of the rainforest in 100-degree weather 5 or 6 or 7 or 8 days after this horrific death, and most everybody died. Mm. So do you know what I mean? Like anything that would have made it simple wasn't going to happen.
Right.
Anything, like even the people who came from Jonestown, like Tim Carter, I think Stephen, Jimmy, a couple people went out to Jonestown to do some identification. But, you know, in that setting, what you're asking for, which is some kind of methodical, scientific or clinical way to do it, that just couldn't happen with the body's at that state of decay. So it's, right. I mean, it's just a horrible situation. Horrible.
All right. And then you have the, you know, the Guyanese, you know, coroner basically totally overwhelmed there was no way he was going to be able to satisfactorily sort through this, and there was no way store everybody. I mean, there just isn't a facility for that or there wasn't at that time. I don't know if there is today. But at that time, there certainly was no sort of facility that could have processed, handled, stored, done any of this in a way that we might think of as remotely modern, even given the year it was in 1978. It was rendered impossible by the conditions, by the distance, by the lack of access. Again, you know, it's just an overwhelming mess, to be honest with you, that just is horrendous. Now, of course, like I said, I'm going to go to that break, and then we're going to hear about some of the people that weren't there, because I want to talk about a couple of guys who ended up in the jungle, you know, two of them at least, with suitcases full of money. Yourself being in Georgetown along with some others, including the young man that we were talking about earlier, who was not present, who ended up carrying Jim Jones' name. It could be that basketball might have actually saved his life. But we're going to get into that after this very short break. Laura Johnston Cole is with me, and the Ocelli Effect is going to continue. We are discussing 40 years after the Jonestown Massacre. And yeah, I will use the word massacre, I'll use the word murder, but you're not going to hear the word suicide coming out when I try to put a title on this, because I'm not buying it. Anyway, at least not for everybody that was there. The Ocelli Effect will continue, and this is a deep, dark subject, but we're going to try and unpack it with somebody who was actually there and understands what was going on when we come back. Stick around.
WallStreetWindow.com. Gold, silver, the stock market. WallStreetWindow.com. The brilliant author of The War State brings you exclusive reports about the big changes upcoming in the markets. WallStreetWindow.com. Perhaps you're invested deeply. Perhaps you're not in deep enough. Maybe you're thinking about getting started. WallStreetWindow.com. Michael Swanson, the brilliant author of The War State, understood these trends professionally for many years, and now he gives you the benefit of his knowledge. WallStreetWindow.com.
News, entertainment, and more. You will learn something, children's. Ocelli.com.
And this would be where I would normally say the second hour of the Ocelli Effect begins, but we're running late. And why I did not want to cut off my guest, Laura Johnston Cole. She is a survivor from Jonestown. She has a book out there which is available, and I will give you guys links to be able to catch up to it and purchase it. Matter of fact, I'll put that in the live chat room at Ocelli.com, and also I'll put it out, you know, like I said, along with the post at the website after the show. So you guys will be able to get your hands on a copy. Also, you'll be able to go over to her website, which is, JonestownSurvivor.com, I believe, is just the website. And you can get a full bio about our guest there. I will put some information in the post as well, but I advise you go to her website and hear it straight from the source. Anyway, we are talking about Jonestown, and it has been more than 40 years. It was November 18th, 1978. When a mass murder occurred. Now, during the break, we did discuss briefly why it is I keep tripping around when I'm saying murder and massacre and a lot of other things, which for the majority of my lifetime has been described as the big mass suicide. But see, a suicide to me would imply that someone made a decision whether they were fully in control of their own faculties or not, someone made a decision to take their own life, and, well, they followed through on it. Now, I've had a discussion on this show that some people didn't like about that particular topic, but here's the truth. I believe that people have a right to live as they please, so long as they harm no one else. So, I leave it at that, but when others are being directed to commit suicide after they've been through a process, or when some people are directly murdered, because in that mess that we were talking about, that the coroner, that the forensic people had to work with in 1978 after bodies were left in the jungle for a week, piled on top of each other without proper paperwork. I mean, the aerial photos, all you got to do is an internet search. Everybody, there are thousands of them out there, thousands of copies of mostly the same photos. You have to know that there was also evidence that some people might have been shot, some people might have been injected, some people maybe were forced in other ways. And we have heard from some survivors how that day went down, but there's the rare case of the individual, the gentleman whose name eludes me at the moment, who just basically says, I walked away during this process and nobody stopped me. I can't remember his name. But
Odell Rose and Stanley Clayton were the two.
Odell, that's the first name of the gentleman who I'm thinking of, who basically makes that statement all the time when he's asked. He says, I walked away and nobody stopped me. And meanwhile, there was another couple of guys who went out into the jungle with big suitcases with about $1 million in cash, according to some people. They had done that as the last directive given to them by Jim Jones. But those stories are often told. You personally, though, were in Georgetown at the time. And I do want to briefly tell that story, because this, to me, is the thing that absolutely just wrenches at my insides thinking about this. Very recently, Jim Jones Jr., again, somebody who I've referenced several times, made a statement about getting a message from his father, who was his adopted father, but also many people in the congregation, in fact, everybody in the congregation, I do believe, referred to Jim Jones as father. But Jim Jones Jr. was adopted and was on the basketball team. Now, that's an odd thing, but that actually positioned him in Georgetown at the time. And you were there as well with some others. If you wouldn't mind telling us that part of the story, while this was all going on in Jonestown, what was going on in Georgetown?
I moved into Georgetown at the end of October. Jim asked me if I would go stay in Georgetown so some of the people who were working in Georgetown could come back out to Jonestown. So at the end of October, I went into Georgetown, and shortly after that, the basketball crew from Jonestown came in to have a competition with some Guyanese teams. So that day, November 18th, about 78 people survived, and about 50 of us were living in the Lamaha Gardens house in Georgetown. So we all lived in one house, and we, you know, were kind of like sardines in a can, you know, spread out on this like 6 or 8 bedroom house. But there were 50 of us living there, including the whole basketball team. And that's why many of the people who survived were the basketball team members, including two of Jim's sons, Stephen and Jimmy. So the house was full. In Jonestown, I think that things were getting more and more, frantic, and people were more and more unhappy. As, you know, I had said, the list of things that were going wrong, Jim was under house arrest in Jonestown because of custody. The Congressman Ryan had government support to come visit him in Jonestown, which Jim hated because he felt that he was in charge and nobody should tell him who could come in, but he was without power. He found out Jonestown would never be self-sufficient. He found out that media back in the United States had discovered all these things he had hidden hidden over the years and all the different, you know, whether it was sex or other issues that he had, you know, dealt with while he was back in San Francisco. So all of this was coming to a head in November of 1978. So the 50 of us lived in town. When Congressman Ryan finally made it to Jonestown, the first night that he was there, there was a whole show put on because in Jonestown we had such multi-talented, you know, singers and musicians and creators and thespians. I mean, we had such a talented crew of people who had all kinds of things that could entertain us, among other things, you know, hard workers, but we had this great diverse group of performers. So they all performed for Congressman Ryan, and then he got up to speak, and a lot of his speech is put out on different videos and YouTube and everything. But basically Ryan stood up and he said,
well, the NBC film crew captured that, which was with him.
That's right.
Yeah, go ahead.
And so Congressman Ryan said, you know, I have seen Jonestown, and I'm amazed at what you've done here in 2 years. I mean, that you have built, you know, 52 cottages and 5 dorms and libraries and school classrooms and a medical clinic. It's just astounding. And so I know many of you love living here, and it's a delight to be here. And then he stepped off the podium, and different people in the crowd started passing notes to mostly the photographers and other media people saying, help me, I need to leave, and Jim's not letting me go. I need to go with you when you leave tomorrow. Do not believe Jim if he says he's going to send us next week. He'll never do it. I need to leave with you. So over the next 12 hours, that night and the next morning, there were roughly 20 people who had decided that they needed to leave with Congressman Ryan, and they didn't trust Jim to let them leave. So in a way, it turned whatever else was going on, the worst thing that Jim could imagine had happened, because he was not somebody who wanted one person to ever leave. He thought that, you know, he thought that Jonestown was the answer for everybody, and if it wasn't, you needed to stay put and finish building Jonestown. And then, you know, see what the next step was. But
excuse me for interrupting really quickly, but also during this time when the notes are being passed and Congressman Ryan confronted Jim Jones with this information that some people wanted to leave, during an exchange like that, actually, somebody pulled a knife and tried to kill him, if I remember correctly. I mean, isn't that true as well?
Right. Ujira Sly did pull a knife on Ryan when he was heading to the truck. But, you know, nothing happened in Jonestown without Jim Jones telling people to do it. Mm. So I'm absolutely sure that that was all orchestrated.
Jim claimed he had nothing to do with that. He claimed he had nothing to do with the shooters, but and all of that. But what you're telling us is that that's absolutely...
Yeah, he was, you know, Jim was in charge of everything. The day that everybody was leaving, if you've seen him on tape, he's totally incoherent. So he was drugged up, you know, he was certainly on drugs and not his, you know, not at the most articulate. But then one of the secretaries, because, you know, it's thought that Carolyn and some of the other secretaries kind of took over when he was not able to cope with what was going on. So, but even so, I just can't imagine anybody in Jonestown being independent enough to take a knife and go to Congressman Ryan without Jim setting it up. I just can't see that that happened. So anyway, so that was all happening, but that was towards the end. But there is a conversation with Jim, and he's having a conversation with Ryan and with one of the people who wants to leave. And Jim said, you know, your line is so stoned, so drugged up that, you know, you could tell that he was just really not even in his right mind. Like, he was just completely gone by then. So then everybody went to the trucks and loaded up and went to the Port Kaituma airstrip. And so after Congressman Ryan and the news crew and, you know, these 15 or 18 people from Jonestown all went to the airstrip, Then Jim loaded up a truck of people with guns to go to the airstrip and kill Congressman Ryan for sure and anybody else who was thinking of leaving. So anybody at the airstrip was fair game. So even Congressman...
These were small planes, so one plane actually got off the ground, if I remember correctly. Then, but the congressman was still waiting there. Along with a woman who was later to become a congressperson as well, and
Jackie Spear,
who was also wounded during the shooting. In fact, she tells a pretty bone chilling story about it.
That's right.
when she is asked, and it's pretty intense. But so the second plane the congressman is waiting for, some other people that claimed to want to leave and some people that did want to leave probably also there, because as you stated about Larry, I think Larry Layton is still there for the second plane, and he was one of the people pretending that he wanted to leave, but he was going to wind up pulling the weapon, which he wound up serving the 18 years for, right?
Right. So there are a couple issues there. First of all, Congressman Ryan came with either no empty seats on his two planes or one empty seat on his planes coming into Jonestown. Mm. So these people who wanted to leave, there were no seats for them to leave on planes. So first thing in the morning, Ryan had to call and order another plane to come in to land at Port Kaituma to take out these extra people. Right. So that was a delay. So instead of leaving in the morning, that delayed their trip. And then there was a huge rainstorm. And then Ujara Sly pulled the knife on Congressman Ryan. So, I mean, that whole day was one event after another that was complicated. Mm-hmm. So the first airplane left, and it had Monica Bagby on it, and she was near death. She had been wounded so badly. So a plane got her into the plane, and they took off. So that was the first plane out. And then there were two planes left when the people came in with the guns. So they immediately shot the airplane, so they were not serviceable. So nobody could leave on it on the other two planes. Mm. They perforated the metal with the shot. So they shot down, they shot and killed Congressman Ryan. They shot and killed Patty Parks, who was a member of People's Temple for many years, came from Indiana, I think. I mean, she had been there a long time, and she and her family were leaving, and she was shot and killed in front of her family, which is horrific. And three other members of the news crew, a photographer, Ron Jacobs, and some others were killed, and many people were wounded. So the people on the truck did shoot and kill Congressman Ryan and others, but, you know, there were many people had guns. So Jackie Spear was wounded a number of times, and she just lay dead. And she was his administrative assistant, and so she just pretended she was dead, and they just walked by her as they were looking for people to shoot. So that's how she saved her life. And so many people were shot and wounded. Finally, the Guyanese in the area, in fact, a Guyanese man in the area was even shot with one of the guns. It grazed his leg because the people from Port Kaituma had come to see the congressman leave, and then all of a sudden all the shooting broke out, and one of them was wounded as well as the people at the airstrip. But it took another day or so for planes to come in and figure out what was going on, because it was so far out of anybody's imagination. That was already at dusk. Nobody could land at the airstrip at night. There were no lights. So even if they flew over, there would be no way to even make sense of things. It wasn't until the next day that they said, okay, well, we think that 300 people died in Jonestown. No, it was 600 people. No, 900 people died in Jonestown. Everybody's dead. But it took several days of them flying back and forth and, you know, finally stopping to do, you know, body count and check for different things and having the coroner, Mutu go out and all these different things to even figure out what happened. It was just beyond conceivable. Do you know, like beyond anything that you could expect.
Well, you have a remote area with no communication, basically, except by radio,
right.
You know, in order to reach somebody from the outside world at all. So, I mean, there's all that going on. Then couple that with a square mile of forensic evidence, which has now been left to sit in the elements. As you stated, there was, you know, rain, and there's just the jungle environment to begin with. I mean, and decomposition. I mean, all of this, it just culminated in an absolute disaster. As far as, you know, being able to respond quickly, as far as being able to sort out what happened. And it's led to a lot of speculation, and in some cases, rightfully so, because it's unknown. You can't state definitively that everybody willingly did X, Y, Z if you can't prove it. You know, we're aware that there were a lot of children present, so you got to assume an adult administered something there, you know, or did something in order to end their lives. It's a horrific situation. So all of this is going on. And as I said, you're in Georgetown. Now, what did you know? I mean, how did word reach you? What happened as far as you were concerned from your personal memory?
Okay. Sorry.
No worries.
So the first thing that happened was that there was a call made from Jonestown to Georgetown. And so it was likely when Jim was in the pavilion coercing people to drink the poison. So it's
I'm going to actually include a copy of this along with the Tonight Show to show you guys that there's an FBI evidence number on it, actually, which I'll provide you the last tape recording, which many of Jones's sermons were tape recorded right there while he was giving them in Jonestown, his sermons, his meetings, his chants, his sometimes incoherent ramblings, quite honestly, because I've listened to a lot of these tapes. It's pretty extensive. But while that's happening, which was not something that happened in 2 minutes' time, it took a while. There was a conversation with people in the congregation. Mm-hmm. I've listened to that tape many times. Quick question. Have you?
No, I have not.
Okay. I just wanted to know. I would think maybe you didn't want to hear it, but I'm sure you've heard it described and you know mm-hmm. the contents of said tape. So while that's going on,
parts of it, but let me just tell you one thing that I am just finding out about the tape. It was stopped and started something like 35 times. Can you tell that when you read it, when you listen to it?
Yes, I can.
Yeah. So whatever happened when Jim was talking, he wanted to make sure it was recording. When anybody else questioned what he was doing or had any other feedback, he would turn off the mic so that only he was on the final tape, which is, I mean, that's Jim Jones to a T.
But what's weird is that there are interactions with other people on there, and you can hear some of the other people talking to him, and one woman saying, oh, listen, you know, we should go to Russia, and, you know, so long as there's life, there's hope, things like that, this woman is saying to him. I mean, there's a lot of exchanges there that can be heard, but there are several starts and stops. Sometimes I can literally hear the erase head being pulled back, like the tape recorder was literally stopped. And in some cases, I'm not sure if it's been edited or not, but I can certainly hear some of the stops. However, what has been, you know, put out there is still, again, remarkably chilling. And I can really sympathize with the idea that you would not want to listen to it in its entirety. Yeah. Given the fact that you probably know every single voice that is on there and you know what's happening intimately. And I got to be honest with you, I don't think I could listen to it if I was you. So, but please go ahead. You're in Georgetown while this is going on, and people could hear mm-hmm. this for themselves if they wish to. It is out there in the public, but go ahead.
So we got a call in Georgetown, and the call came in to Sharon Amos, who was one of Jim's confidants for many years, certainly from the late 60s. She and her three children were part of People's Temple, and she was one of Jim's most trusted zealots. So not just trusted, but somebody who would do whatever it takes to support Jim Jones. That was her, you know, that was her position in People's Temple. Anything Jim wanted, she couldn't get work fast enough to get it. So she was in charge in Georgetown. So the message came in from Jonestown saying, okay, a coded message that was planned ahead of time, but basically said, everybody in Jonestown is dying, so all of you in Georgetown, San Francisco, Los Angeles, and Redwood Valley need to commit revolutionary suicide. So Sharon got the message, and I was in the house in Georgetown. I was the only one with a car. So she sent me across town to get Stephen and Jimmy Jones, who were in town, you know, with the basketball team, and a few other people. So I drove across town and got Stephen and Jimmy and a few others. And then when they got to the house, they went up in the upstairs back bedroom, which was the private area that Jim stayed in when he was in the house. And it wasn't really available or audible to the rest of the house. So they had a meeting back there, and Sharon explained to Stephen and Jimmy that Jim had sent a message that it was time to commit revolutionary suicide. So right away, Jimmy and Stephen said, okay, let me get out to Jonestown. I'll stop it. I need to get out there to stop it. But, you know, by then it was already late afternoon or early evening. There was no way to get out to Jonestown, and it was too late to stop what was already starting out there. So they couldn't get out there. But Sharon said, but Jim said we should do it. And Stephen and Jimmy said, absolutely not. They stopped it. We're not following that instruction, and we're not telling anybody. We're not discussing it. It's not going to happen. So they stopped it. So they came out of the meeting. Nobody said anything. We all went about our business. Like with everything in People's Temple, we were booked day and night. So like I went to a talent show put on by the People's National Congress, the political, you know, the government. And different people went to all kinds of different activities around the city. When we came back, the Guyanese Defense Force had taken over our house. And so we said, well, what happened? They said, we're going to have you all go into the living room. So they had us all, the 50 of us, sit around in a circle around all the walls in the living room and kitchen and dining room. And then as we were all sitting there, they brought out the body bags of Sharon Amos and her three kids. She had killed her three kids and herself.
Now, what's really strange about this is that, again, in a recent interview, Jim Jones Jr. said that that he had received kind of a coded message. Now, I'm not sure how he had received it or if he had gotten it from her, but it was really, really strange because he said something about cleanup or whatever. I forget the exact code words, but it was really an innocuous sort of phrase, and he knew what it meant. But he said he absolutely refused, and he said there was no way he was going to distribute that message or be party to it.
That's right.
I'm just saying that it's absolutely corroborated by the young man himself. Well, not so much a young man nowadays, I guess, but he was a very young man then. So but that to me just is. Absolutely. I mean, to be involved in a crowd, you know, the group mentality, the crowd mentality, people talk about this a lot, especially when the subject of Jonestown comes up. And they say, well, you know, they used to say anyway all the time. Well, you know, how is it that so many people would turn around and take their own lives? And you people would say, well, it's groupthink, you know. And it's true that a crowd of people can encourage actions that that people might not individually take. I mean, this is a reality. This is a real psychiatric phenomenon, right? This is something that you're personally aware of. You know that this is just, you know, reality. Crowds promote certain behaviors among themselves. But this woman, following orders from a distance, murders her children and then takes her own life. And she's 24 hours away from this place by boat. I mean, I'm understanding you correctly, right?
That's right.
I have no words to express what that means. You know,
she was in that position because Jim knew that when he gave her that instruction, she was going to follow his instruction to the T. So, in a way, that brings up another question. Like, when I even wrote my book, one of the things I said that was my survival was a fluke. And so when I wrote the book, I did feel that way. But, you know, that's going on like almost 10 years ago that I wrote the book. Mm-hmm. So today my perspective is different. See, Sharon Amos and I worked together in the welfare department for 7 years. So for the minute I moved into People's Temple and went to work at the welfare department, I worked with Sharon. She was a social worker and I was an eligibility worker. And so she was diabetic. And so when she got exhausted, I would help drive her where she needed to go. So I would be her driver to San Francisco or Los Angeles. I would pick her up wherever she needed to go, take her. So I drove a Greyhound bus, but I also drove Sharon anywhere she needed to go. And at the welfare department, what we would do is she would park outside the welfare department, and then in the morning she would say, I need to take a nap. So she would come tell me to come wake her up in 15 minutes. So she'd go out to her car, and in 15 minutes I'd walk out and wake her up from her 15-minute break, and she'd go back to work. So we had established kind of a mutual respect or, you know, some kind of a relationship over those 7 years working together every day. And I knew her family really well, her older daughter Leanne and her younger kids Martin and Krista. So I knew them. So my updated kind of thought of what happened in Georgetown is Jim knew that Congressman Ryan was coming to Guyana. He knew he would probably go to Georgetown first. So the first thing he did is he got anybody out of the house in Georgetown who wasn't going to follow an instruction. Anybody who was unhappy, he was going to get out of there. So he sent me into Georgetown because Sharon Amos was my friend. Sharon Amos was going to get the instruction, unquestionably do whatever the instruction was, and he thought she could coerce or get me to follow her example. So it wasn't, not only was it not a fluke, but Jim thought that Sharon could make an impression on me that if she said, Jim said commit suicide, he thought that I would follow that instruction if it came from Sharon.
He also thought his son would follow through, apparently, or at least one of them would, right?
You know, I don't think he ever thought that Stephen and Jimmy would follow that instruction because really? He, you know, from early on, he had been so emotionally abusive to both of the boys that, you know, he was a good father some days maybe, but then there were so many things he did that were just horrific in his treatment of all his kids. I can't imagine that he thought Stephen would ever follow that instruction, or Jimmy. I think he might have hoped, but I think that there was no way that Stephen and Jimmy are going to take an instruction from Sharon about a message she got off the radio. There was a message from Jim. That was never going to happen.
Well, it's an interesting. It's an interesting dynamic when you talk about a serial abuser of any type and the level mm-hmm. of control they feel as though they have over their victims.
That's right. That's true.
And sometimes they do feel as though they have absolute control because that appears to be the case. It's not necessarily true because
right.
we do retain things internally quite often that are not readily visible to the observer, and especially not somebody who is quite narcissistically involved and so involved with controlling so many different things, he might have missed the mark on that, and
I think that's
missed the mark on you
true.
As well, you know, and it could be that you just retained enough of yourself to not fall into the same trap that your friend did. I mean, I hate to put it that way, but
you know,
that's what it sounds like to me.
I would love to, you know, take all the kudos and say, oh, yeah, you were smarter. I never heard the conversation. I was never part of that conversation. It was between Sharon and Stephen and Jimmy and a couple other people. I never heard the conversation until the Guyanese Defense Force took over the house. So I never knew that was an instruction or an option or anything.
Well,
so,
let me put it to you this way then. I mean, if you were to go back in time and imagine that you had received that instruction. Perhaps it's somebody else further in the chain. You know, there was probably a planned chain of individuals that should have delivered these instructions. Some of them didn't cooperate. If it had been delivered to you, putting yourself back then, I mean, not today, obviously, mm-hmm. but putting yourself back then, do you honestly think you would have done it?
No, I don't have any question in Jonestown, that because that was my family that I expected to live my entire life with. And there would never be a time that I could say, okay, so 917 other people are dying and I'm going to run into the woods. No, that was my family. That was my adopted family. I cannot imagine thinking that, oh yeah, I'm different, and so I'm going to survive when everybody around me is dying. So that just wouldn't have happened in Jonestown. In Georgetown, you know, it was really different. We were on a road that led to another road, that led to government, that led to an airport, that had other people around. You know, a little bit of what you were saying about, you know, if you're in a group of people, 900 people, and you see people dying and children dying, and Jim started with the children first so that parents would have, you know, much less resilience to say, I'm going to survive this even though you've killed my children. I mean, I think that in Jonestown it's one thing. In Georgetown, really, that distance, I couldn't really say. It depends so much on exactly what would happen that day.
Mm. So, I mean, there is a feasible scenario in which you could have been among them, is
yeah.
what you're saying. Okay.
Right.
No, I asked the question objectively here, that's all.
Yeah.
So, I have a couple of other thoughts in my mind before, because we're almost out of time, but I do advise people to pick up your book and to look at the Jonestown story in much greater depth and not simply watch one documentary, because I sampled a few earlier today just to give myself again a refresher on a few things. And I notice that the agenda of the documentaries sort of drives a lot of what it is they're showing you.
And, that's right.
And I advise people to make up their own minds about what it is they saw. Now, I think that it is not disputable that this is a tragedy. I think it is not disputable that this is a horrendous mass murder. Now, as to the level at which you want to put culpability on whomever, I leave that to the listener to decide. But I will say that that this is something that requires greater examination, and I do believe it should be studied at length by anyone who feels as though the individuals who are often led by someone else need to retain some semblance of separation from it, and it's a cautionary tale. It's just a cautionary tale on so many levels that I think it is worthy of study. It's worthy of acknowledgement. It's worthy of preservation as a historical reality. And just on a personal note, I hope that I never live to see something like this again. You know, I don't believe that any loss of life unnecessarily is good at any point in time. But something like this, it just seems to me as though it's so terribly avoidable. And with that in mind, I want to ask you another question. Do you think that it's possible that this could have gone a whole different direction had it not been just for the visitation of Leo Ryan and the people who came with him? That's one question. And the other is, do you think that it was inevitable that the situation in Jonestown was going to end in some sort of disaster one way or another?
You know, I think that Ryan's visit did not create the end. The end was already created because Jim was so paranoid, and his health was failing, and he didn't want to turn over leadership to somebody else who would get credit for him. So I think that Jim's declining health and Jonestown not being self-sufficient and those kinds of things really had already determined that, there was going to be an ending of some sort. The thing that might have changed it if Jim had died and the triumvirate, there was a triumvirate set up to take over leadership. If a triumvirate had taken over either because Jim died or became, you know, unable to function and people allowed him to just step back or forced him to step back or purged his leadership or however that happened, the people who would have been in charge, I think, would have likely let everybody who wanted to leave, leave, and then it would have been a smaller cadre of people who wanted to make it work. So it wouldn't have happened if Jim had not been in leadership. So I know Stephen and Jimmy feel, you know, if they had been able to be in George, in Jonestown, they could have stopped it. I think Jim had so much planning into the final results that I don't know that they could have stopped it the same day. But I think if Jim were not in power, however that would have happened, then I think the whole thing would have been averted. I think nobody would follow instructions from anybody else in Jonestown about killing them, their children and themselves. So that would have averted it, and it would have saved people, and people could have come back if they wanted or stayed or whatever. So I think that would have changed the scenario a lot.
So definitely but, not inevitable. It's just a matter of it was inevitable if, you know,
if Jim stayed there.
If Jim stayed there, which he stayed there long enough to do this, which and, is really it, another thing just quickly is that I noticed, again, sampling these more recent ones, that there were many a statement that, you know, somebody wished they had been there or wished they had been able to do something. It's very difficult to fight a crowd, okay, as an individual. So, you know, again, I don't know that all of these people with this good intent in their hearts or good idea in their hearts about changing the direction of what was happening that day, given the circumstances, I don't think that they would have been anything other than a lot of them probably another body.
You know, I think that we could speculate forever, but we don't really know. All we know is that Jim was a master manipulator who had set this in place with all the organization it took to get the vats and the poison and the Flavor Aid and everything, and that he had set up the community to attack anybody who was attacking him. So he had time to put all the pieces in play. And so it's very hard to know who could have been successful. So that day, if somebody had started a month earlier to talk to people and say, okay, if this happens, this is your role and this is your role. If that kind of organization had happened ahead of time, it's hard to tell because Jim was really unable to cope. And so, you know, I just don't know how much we would have had to see. You know, judging for myself, I just don't know. I mean, but
well,
again,
but when people are so emotionally and psychologically vested in a leader, and then that guy has a meltdown, regardless of whether it's Jim Jones or, you know, a political leader, another religious figure, major, minor, doesn't matter. If they have a meltdown, it affects the people that they now have under their influence. I mean, it's just, it's part of the reality. So in the closing minutes here of this conversation, because we only got a couple left, I just have one last thing that I really need to ask you, which is for somebody who's listening to this, whether it's the first time they're hearing about Jonestown or it's, you know, it's just a refresher or it's some new, clearer information that we've given them tonight, what is it, you know, in a couple of minutes that you would like them to take away from this conversation tonight? And again, JonestownSurvivor.com is Laura's website. Laura Johnston Cole, you could certainly search her out on the internet and find out a lot of information about her and the various places you can learn about Jonestown obviously are out there. I'll provide you guys with lots of links. But overall, what is it that you would like people to take away from our conversation and your story in general?
I would say that there's so much information out there. You need to check your sources. The alternative consideration of Jonestown and People's Temple has hundreds of transcribed tapes. They've had a Jonestown Report that's printed online as a newsletter every year for the last 20 years at least. It has writings from all the survivors, Jimmy and Stephen Jones and many others, researchers, cult experts, other survivors, family members and distant relatives of survivors. I would say that if you're going to look at reading something, the best thing to do would to be read survivors' stories, because so many times the other things that are published are there just to get headlines and sell newspapers or books. Some recent new books have come out. Yusi Kewana, who's Guyanese, wrote a wonderful, wonderful book, Jonestown from the Guyanese Perspective, which is just really articulate, and the Guyanese point of view is not something we even discussed here today in 2 hours, right. But it's something really important about why Guyana would allow People's Temple to come in and run their own property with their own rules. Another book that's really good is The Road to Jonestown, Jim Jones and People's Temple by Jeff Gwynn. And Jeff Gwynn interviewed every single person he could interview, and he had no vested interest in what you had to say. He would just open the door and say, so what is it, what are your thoughts on, or how do you feel? And then he would let you run with it. So he's one of the very few people who have interviewed me and many of us who actually let us do the talking. The other thing is that a friend of mine wrote to me, and it's kind of crass in a way, but she said, so Laura, I've been finding out more about People's Temple, and what I thought before was that members of People's Temple were lemming, jumping off the cliff. And in fact, they were visionaries who had an eye on making the world better and the community better. And somehow, that's it exactly. If you think that we were sheep being led to slaughter 3,000 or 4,000 miles from home, then you missed the point. None of us were being led to slaughter. We thought either we were starting a new world, a new utopia, or we were getting away from a racist Ku Klux Klan-run country that was killing off our leaders that had courage and integrity and leaving us with Richard Nixon or some other people who were in government. So we were going for some purpose. It was either for a better world or to leave a world that we couldn't control, that was out of control, to try and do something better. So you have to understand who we were. And then, you know, we were just conned by the best con man I've seen until, you know, current administration, the best con man around. So we were out conned, too naive.
Well, and there it is, you know, again, and it ends up in, unfortunately, like I said, a calamity of tragedies, you know, and multiple levels and multiple layers. And like I said, there's easily way more than those 900 stories that might be encased in this event and in what happened. I mean, there's thousands
That's right.
upon thousands. And I think they are all things which should be studied and understood, especially by people who make flippant remarks about this and think that it's, you know, just the grist for the conspiracy mill, if you will. It's a lot more than that. Of course, there are elements of that, and I didn't even want to go into it tonight. I really wanted to get your perspective, and hopefully that's what we've done, because you are a witness to history. Whether you volunteered for that, you know, in the way that you ended up being a witness is another story, but you certainly were a witness to history. And I think your story needs to be told by a lot more people and presented by a lot more people. Excuse me, told by you, but presented by a lot more people. So I encourage everybody to go to JonestownSurvivor.com, begin there, and also all the references that Laura made here tonight. I appreciate your patience and your candor. You know, it's just really, really remarkable, and I want to thank you for being very patient with me and the listeners' questions. Laura Johnston Cole once again. So this show is all done, but don't worry, I'll be back again tomorrow with something entirely different. But I urge you to follow up on the discussion from tonight's show and learn as much as you can. Perhaps we will be able to avoid something like this in the future. Anyway, Wednesday or Woden's Day is all done. And again, I am Neely O'Kelly. All of you who participate, listen, or do anything involving this show, you are all the effect. Have a good night.
This is, what I'm talking about now is in the dispensation of judgment. This is a revolutionary, suicide council. I'm not talking about self-destruction. I'm talking about, but we have no other road. I will take your call. We will put it to the Russians, and I can tell you the answer now because I'm a prophet.
Videos, physical swag, and other features pending. Restrictions only apply.